Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, those of you who've been listening to American Variety for a while might have picked up that a theme that runs through a lot of my choices of guests is people who are what I'll call highly self-realizing. And by that, I mean people who have an unusual dream or a daunting goal that they decide to pursue, and they achieve it, against all odds and often in the face of criticism and discouragement from everybody around them. And in the process, they become more fully themselves than most of us ever do. My guest today is someone who's very much a self-realized person. In fact, it's hard for me to think of anyone who's led a more diverse and colorful patchwork of a life while being successful at basically everything he does than my guest, whose name is Peter Coyote. If you've heard his name, you might remember it because it's unusual. And if this were TV, you might recognize his face because he's acted in well over 100 films and TV shows. Among other awards, he's won an Emmy. But what you're likely to recognize most is his voice, because Peter has been, I'm pretty sure, the most prolific narrator of documentaries and films about nature, the environment, pop culture, technology, and history of our lifetime over the past 30 years or so. When I reached out to him to invite him to come on the show, I called him the voice from the sky, kind of the background soundtrack for so many documentaries that his voice is almost an unconscious part of how we see documentary film. Kind of like, oh, I don't know, Donald Sutherland or James Earl Jones or Sam Elliott are in some other genres. Peter's a prolific author who has written 2 books, and he's a full-fledged Zen priest. But before all that, he was an iconic figure in the counterculture movement of the 60s, one of the founders of something called the Diggers in San Francisco. So we'll talk about all of that. But after this very lengthy introduction, let me finally say, welcome, Peter.
Thanks, Court. You forgot to tell how they found me in the bulrushes.
Oh, well, hopefully we won't throw you into a burning bush anyway. So, all right. Well, anyway, so with all that, it's hard to know where to start. So I guess let's start at more or less the beginning of your journey after college in sleepy Iowa, of all places, when you got to San Francisco, just as the counterculture was starting to flower. I guess that's a pun, sort of. They say if you remember the 60s, you really weren't there, right? But I'm pretty sure you remember it all well. And I think you first joined the San Francisco mime troupe, right? So what was all that about?
Well, actually, the real story starts in college. And it starts during the Cuban Missile Crisis, where U.S. and Russian boats were facing off, and 14 of us at Grinnell College, where I lived, were really afraid we were not going to live to grow up. Mm-hmm. The United States was full of nuclear anxiety. There were movies like On the Beach going on and The Day the Earth Stood Still and invasions from outer space. And it was sublimated, but it was a very real thing. Nuclear weapons were on the fore. So 14 of us raised the money to buy 2 old cars, and we went to Washington, and we picketed the White House, and we supported Kennedy's peace race, and we were calling for an end to the resumption of nuclear testing. And Kennedy was on his way to Arizona, but he saw a report in the New York Times about us, and he invited us into the White House, which was the first time in history it had ever happened.
Really?
And we met with McGeorge Bundy, who was his national security advisor. Mm-hmm. It was a big deal. I learned basically that politics doesn't work the way that I had been taught it worked in high school. But we wrote letters to every college in the United States, and we kept other protests going for an entire year. February of 1963, 25,000 students showed up in Washington for the first big student demonstration. And Tom Hayden called the Grinnell 14 the beginning of the student peace movement, or the student movement, period. So when I went to San Francisco, I went with this feeling that we had the power to do a lot. If you had a good idea and you were willing to put yourself on the line and just go for it, you could get a lot accomplished. That's important to know because that was the kind of motivation for the entire counterculture. A kind of belief in our own ability and the way we perceived the world. And the way we perceived the world needed to be corrected because we went to Washington thinking that we were bringing intelligence to our leaders. Hmm. We were telling them what young people felt in the field and what we were worried about. When I looked into McGeorge Bundy's eyes, I realized that we were just a problem to be solved for his president. Mm-hmm. We were no more important to him than people waving goodbye to the Queen Mary was to the captain.
Yeah.
And it saved me a lot of trouble. I resolved I would never walk in the street again carrying a sign, and that if I wanted to get this guy's attention, I was going to have to come back with an army. And a few years later, I thought that the counterculture was going to be the Army.
Well, you did start as an idealistic young kid at the top. You didn't fool around in Grinnell. You went right to the White House. It's amazing. So I see where you got the drive and the confidence, I guess, that has propelled you through all of the other changes in career that we're going to try to talk about. So I started off with what sounds like a little light dance thing, the San Francisco Mime Troupe. But what you started off actually with that you just described was a good deal heavier, to use a 60s phrase.
The San Francisco Mime Troupe was a little street theater that did 16th century Italian Commedia dell'arte plays, which are like Punch and Judy.
Okay.
They're full of stock characters, they're masked. There's a lot of lovers sneaking out as husbands are coming in, and a lot of full-bosomed maids that are smarter than everybody. But we repurposed these plays for kind of progressive political politics. And we were kind of like the darlings of the left. And we toured the country a lot. We got arrested a lot. And the Diggers grew out of the San Francisco Mime Troupe, out of the belief that we thought we could do more than just perform. And when you talk about confidence, it wasn't exactly confidence. I think that what I have, and I think what my friends had, was authenticity. We were doing things we really believed. So there was no question of confidence or not. This is who we were. This is what we want to try to do. And as long as we stuck to that, we knew what we were doing.
Well, I mean, I was there too. I'm a few years younger than you, but I'm no kid anymore, right? So I remember the 60s very well. And it started off as an idealistic thing, and it became soured and sullied badly later, as you well know. But I think you were at the cutting edge of that idealism, and so that's what you really just described. I mean, I called it confidence to go to the White House, but it's a sort of nerve that accompanies it in your case. For those who are too young or were too stoned or just too unaware to remember it, tell us about the Diggers.
Well, the Diggers was based on the idea that we were all artists. And we didn't want to grow up in a world of communism where we were having to do plays about heroic elevator operators or paintings about heroic bus drivers. We wanted to live in a world in which we could be authentic. And most of the resistance of the 60s was kind of leftist stuff. So we challenged ourselves to imagine a world we wanted to live in and to make it real by acting it out. So the first thing we did was we wanted to take care of all the runaways who were coming to the Haight-Ashbury. And the city was doing nothing. It was getting rich off tourism, coming to ride tourist buses through the Haight-Ashbury and look at the freaks.
Yeah.
But nobody was taking care of them. So we started feeding people. We sent our women out to the farmers markets, and we got enough food to feed 600 people a day. And the only thing you had to do to get the meal was step through a big yellow square, 6 feet by 6 feet, called the free frame of reference. We had to bring a bowl and a spoon. And it wasn't about charity at all. It was about wanting to live in a world with free food. And then we built a free store where we would collect and repair goods, and you could get everything you needed to run a life. You could get clothes, tools, furniture, records, bicycles, radios. And the subliminal question was, why do you want to get a job to become an employee, to make the money to become a consumer? We'll give you the stuff. Now what do you want to do? And so the Diggers basically created a radical alternative culture. We had doctors coming in from the med school one day a week at the free store and serving a free medical clinic, which is still running. And you say something that I disagree with. You said that it started out idealistic and it went really, really bad. So the first thing I want to point out is that there's still 108 Diggers on an email exchange, chipping in money every month to take care of 12 of our people who are old and indigent. And the thing that went bad, if you think about it, was Altamont, which was the rock and roll, big money, Rolling Stones, Grateful Dead reality that we warned them about. Because the Grateful Dead first came to me and Peter Berg to hold this event, because the Diggers were famous for holding huge parties. All the big parties in Golden Gate Park, where the rock bands played, were thrown by us. And they were thrown on the summer solstice, or the vernal equinox, where there was a planetary frame of reference. Mm-hmm. Nobody was a star. The planet was the star. And consequently, there was no violence or no competition. We warned them that if they got one stage and they put big time stars on it, they were using the audiences as extras in a documentary movie about it. So it wasn't really a free concert. And the audience began to understand that and resented it. So when the 60s was over in the mid 70s, Reagan and all those people very consciously began to miscast it as a failed experiment. We were a bunch of old farts with clunky peace symbols and bell-bottom clothes because they didn't want another generation of dedicated, educated, smart, politically resistant students. So they funneled the next generation into Wall Street to get their BMWs and to get their material possessions. We may have used drugs, but we weren't smuggling drugs in body bags out of Vietnam and selling them in the black ghettos to pay for Iran-Contra. We weren't declaring war on the hungry, training our armies to fight the hungry for the fat down there. So we were not creating the collapse of the savings and loan industry. We may have not had any money, but we weren't destroying the national economy. So all of those things about how bad it turned are all deflections about what was really going on. 1973, Paul Volcker raising interest rates 5 points in a single day and bankrupting 22 million farmers. The diggers and the counterculture did no damage on that scale whatsoever. We may be hurt ourselves, but I'm not buying the corporate media view of how the 60s turned out. Because our kids are psychologists and environmentalists. They're politically active. Most of them survived really well. And we're still holding on to our same values and same beliefs. We just live in a world that's changed, and we have to adjust to it.
So I kind of miscommunicated. I didn't mean to say at all that the diggers went south or went sour. And I did more broadly mean that the counterculture did, and that's part of what you were pushing back on there. But really what I mean is that the counterculture, partly for the reasons you just outlined, petered out, excuse the another pun there. But anyway, it became more about sex and drugs because a different type of people got involved, and it just sort of flattened out into something more nasty in a way.
I just want to say one thing. I don't want to leave it sit with your definition,
okay,
which is what happened is children came along, and children created a certain kind of order and necessity for order. That meant that the drugs, free sex, and rock and roll of the communes couldn't continue. So a lot of it disappeared. And then what you had were a lot of economic casualties and runaways running to the hate without any abiding philosophy.
Right.
Whereas we took on the active work of raising our families. So that's all I had to say about it.
So let's get back on the diggers for just a minute. When you were talking about it, you used the word free many times, as in basically freedom of everything. And did you find that over time that utopian idea was sustainable? I mean, you did talk about the kids who kept coming and coming and coming, partly because the freedom was there. Did you find that it changed in a way that became unsustainable after a while?
Well, it's unsustainable because it's at odds with the way the universe is. In the universe, everything is interdependent. Everything is joined to everything else. So the diggers were never presented as a viable economy. It was more like a three-year art project to get people to think about fame and money and the system in a very different way.
All right. So at a certain point, it seems to me you really were leaving what I think you were calling at the time community anarchy behind and moving onto the path to your professional career. When you went to work for the San Francisco Arts Commission and later the California Arts Council, right? So that was like a big change, a big move in a way.
The San Francisco Art Commission, there was a guy named John Kreidler who got the government to dedicate a certain amount of training money. It was a program called CETA,
yeah,
the Comprehensive Education and Training Act. He got them to dedicate it to artists. And so 1,000 people showed up for 100 jobs, and I got one of them. Mm. And we were hired to, you know, I was teaching in kind of low-income schools, teaching theater and acting, and we were doing that for a while. But in 1975, my friend Gary Snyder won the Pulitzer Prize, and Jerry Brown picked him to run a state arts council, to organize it with working artists and to reconceive it. And Gary asked me to join him. The next year, I was elected chairman, and I was the chairman for 4 years until they passed a law saying I couldn't do it anymore. But we raised the budget from $1 to $18 million a year, and we really revolutionized the way of thinking about art. And in order to do that, I had to learn how to talk to conservatives, to Republicans, to people very, very different from me. And at that point, I realized that I had kind of transcended the counterculture. Yeah. I was in the middle of the majority culture. And I was broke. My dad had died broke. And I had a child. And I thought, I'm going to try acting for 5 years. I'll still be young enough to do something else if it doesn't work. And I got lucky. And, you know, 150 films later, I'm trying to get out of it. But that the political work was the big training ground in expanding my bookends to include everybody and not just people like me.
Yeah, so that was a very unusual and highly individual springboard from the community activism you were doing before in San Francisco into being what amounts to kind of not a bureaucrat exactly, but an official in a way of the arts organization in California. And so that was a big change. And again, kind of the signature, I guess, of your ability to segue in a big way from one thing to the next. You mentioned all these movies. I mean, just for our audience, you've had starring roles in movies ranging from E.T. to A Walk to Remember to Aaron Brockovich. You know, I mean, some of them are small movies and some of them are big movies, you know, so you've had quite an acting career. And I think you had limited formal acting training, right? Not much at all.
Yeah, I was very lucky. I'm a pretty good actor. I'm not a great actor. I'm not Daniel Day-Lewis, you know. But I did a good job. But, I mean, I was always a writer who was making his living as an actor. I didn't leave San Francisco. I didn't have a publicist. I didn't go down to big screenings and openings. And I paid a tax on my career because of that. I didn't do the things that you would have to do if you really were serious about being a star. And I don't blame people who are serious about it, but I was living in a Zen Buddhist monastery, and I was serious about being a Zen student, and I was serious about thinking that I was off stage much more of my life than on stage. So if I was going to take impeccable care of anything, it ought to be my offstage life. And so that's the way I organized myself.
Yeah, so I guess you approached acting as kind of, let me just call it maybe in a dilettante way, and you viewed it as sort of moonlighting. And so from that perspective, you did extremely well because most people plunge into it to the hilt 100%, probably don't end up in nearly as many movies as you did.
But anyway. I wouldn't say that I was a dilettante. I really did my best. I worked really, really hard. First of all, I was 40 when I got my Screen Actors Guild union card.
Wow.
Which gave me a very short shelf life as a leading man. By the time you hit 50, you're about over. After 50, you become a character actor, which I did. And, you know, at a certain point, my career just gelled into being a crap head in a suit. And so anytime they needed a corrupt politician or president or senator or corporate executive, they would call me for that. And I just didn't find it interesting. And at the point at which my kids were both through graduate school debt free, I thought, I don't really need to do this anymore. And I'd rather stay on my farm and work. And so I occasionally work. I did a job in Tulsa a couple months ago because I needed a new roof on my house. But I'm just not very interested in it anymore.
All right. Well, give me like one example, if you can, Peter, of during that whole long period, really, where you were involved in so many movies. Is there one that sticks out as being really a memorable or satisfying experience in your life?
There were a number. I did a film for Roman Polanski called Bitter Moon, which is sort of a cult movie. I did a film in France and Italy called A Man in Love, which put me on the cover of every magazine in Europe. And both people who saw it in America thought it was fantastic. I love doing The Jagged Edge. I love doing E.T. I love doing Outrageous Fortune. You know, I was really lucky. I got a lot of roles, but I didn't get, you know, there was a certain level of roles that I couldn't crack through. Maybe it was a limit on my talent. If I'd been 20, I would have gone to England and studied at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts or Lambda. I think they turn out the best English-speaking actors in the world. But I had to make money. I mean, I had to buy a house. I had to get my kids in a good school. Yeah, sure. And so I just, you know, harnessed up and did it. And maybe I didn't have the confidence in my ability because I wasn't trained that would have allowed me to be braver and take bigger risks.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Peter Coyote, who I kind of call the voice from the sky. He's been an actor in about 140 movies, and he's also narrated many, many of the documentaries that all of us have heard for the last 40 years. You can hear Peter's voice, which is often described as silky, and it's also described as sounding a little like Henry Fonda's voice, and I can hear that too. But I recognize Peter Coyote's voice if I'm watching a documentary, no matter what it might be, within a second, you know. It's perfect for narration, and I think that's because it's where the narrator's voice should kind of get into the listener's brain without attracting much attention to itself. Does that make sense to you, Peter?
It does. I also think that I can't say much about my voice because it's my mother's voice.
Oh, yeah?
I got my mother's voice box. But what I do is I read really well, and I'm able to take the listener through a series of clauses in a sentence. So I can say, you know, I was on the radio talking to Court, who runs his own show, who previously had lived in Florida and now lives in Tennessee. And I can take you through each of those phrases without losing you. I mean, maybe the voice inspires confidence, but the other part of it is that you can understand me and it's all clear.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best way to say it really, or the simplest way to say it, is just that it's easy to listen to and it comes across clearly. The stuff you're saying gets into your brain and you follow it, you know, without having to focus on the voice itself. So it's kind of a good medium, basically. Well, you've been working as a narrator of documentaries since the early 80s, which is a good while back there. But it seems to me that your career as a narrator, you know, looking at your kind of your bio, really took off around the turn of this century. Did you make that shift intentionally and decide, okay, this is going to be an easier way for me to make a living?
No, not at all. You know, I used to do a lot of ads, and they paid really well. And, you know, for instance, when I did E.T., I was out of work for a year. When I did The Jagged Edge, I was out of work for 9 months. People don't think about this. There's 97% of actors that are out of work at any given moment.
Sure.
And the average income for actors, including the salaries of the Tom Cruises and the, you know, Brad Pitts, is about $5,000 to $6,000 a year.
Oh, good Lord.
So the ads and the voiceovers came in as a great way to supplement my income. Then at a certain point, the kids that produced The Civil War for Ken Burns came and asked me to narrate a thing called The West, an eight-hour history of the West. And Ken heard it, and then he asked me to narrate the national parks. And from that time on, he and I have worked continuously together. I think we've done 8 shows together. We're getting ready to do a new one. We did, the last one was Vietnam, and this September there'll be a 16-hour history of country music that's coming out, September 15th, and then sometime this year we'll do Hemingway.
It is. I mean, each one is so epic. I mean, like, I think it was 12 hours for national parks, and then 20 hours, you mentioned the Vietnam War. I watched all of that, and, you know, 10 two-hour segments. I mean, that's a lot of reading, a lot of narration, a lot of work, so... How do you work? Just in a nutshell, and we're kind of getting toward the end of the show here, Peter, but what's the process like?
You know, there is no process. I never read anything first. And I really believe that when I read it, I get the clearest images in my mind, and then my emotions automatically adjust to those images. I never work or polish anything. And then I call it playing jazz. And if I make a mistake, we can redo it. Basically, I can go through pages for Ken Burns, and we do it, and they'll say, well, that's perfect. Let's do it again, because you always want to have a safety. But I don't have a method. It's just to be there and let the words I'm reading play on me.
So you don't even read it in advance? You just sit down cold and start reading it, and that's the first take?
Absolutely cold.
Wow.
When I first met Ken, he came in with the national parks. He had about 8 yellow pads, and he had, you know, 20 CDs and highlighters and magic markers and pens and pencils. And I asked him, what's all that? He said, well, that's so you can watch it and make your notes and do your thing. And I said, oh, no, man, I'll do it when I get in the studio. It's okay. And there was kind of a glacial pause. And he said, no, you don't know how impeccable I am. And I said, oh, well, you don't know how good I am. And there was another glacial pause. And he said, okay, well, we'll try it. I'll rent a studio for a month and we'll go. I said, no, it's 9 hours. We'll do it in 6 days. We'll do an episode and a half a day. And he said, no. And then the third day, he jumped up out of his chair and he said, I'll never use anyone else.
Yeah, I guess you convinced him. You're impeccable, too. He'd met his match.
Well, we're actually cooperative and not competitive, so it's not a match.
You know, just very quickly, do you have a home studio? I mean, it sounds like you do this so on the run and so ad hoc, and again, I'll use this word you didn't seem to like, but with so much confidence. Do you have a home studio, or do you go on site for each of these things?
There's a good engineer about 5 minutes from my house who has a good studio where I record. I don't want to be responsible for all the technicalities.
Technology, sure. Yeah, it's a big deal. Well, you're one of the, I'd say, the few prominent counterculture figures who somehow made a smooth transition into a successful creative career that is influential, but in a low-key way. I mean, you're not a powerhouse corporate lawyer who started off saying, I'm going to change the system from the inside. And you didn't end up dying under a bridge either. You're successful. You didn't go to either of those extremes that so many people in the 60s did.
Yeah,
you're successful, but in a low-key way. And as I said at the beginning, I mean, I think everybody's probably heard your voice, but 98% of them don't know your name or whose voice that is, right? So the very personal question, real quick, how did you manage to survive those early years and the drugs and the craziness of it all and keep your head on as straight as you obviously have? Is there some simple bullet answer?
Well, luck is part of the answer. And then I was in my early 30s when I started meditating and really changed my life. Okay. And so 45 years later, I'm still meditating and I'm a transmitted Buddhist teacher. That's what really created my center of gravity.
That's a good answer. I understand that. Perfect. Peter published his autobiography called Sleeping Where I Fall in 1998. But I guess that was a little premature because he's still breathing and kicking, as you hear. So in 2015, he did it again with a memoir titled The Rain Man's Third Cure, An Irregular Education.
Thanks, Court. The second book is about mentors and teachers.
Ah.
And the first book is about the diggers and the anarchist counterculture. And myself is just sort of a thread through the pearl necklace, and each pearl is a different person. So they're memoirs, but they're not just all about me, me, me.
And Peter's website is at petercoyote.com, petercoyote.com. Peter, this has been fascinating, one of the more interesting and lively ones I've done in a while. And
Court.
Yeah, I want to thank you so much for being on with me.
Well, thank you for asking me.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.